Welcome to the 11th message of our series, Live in Grace, which is part two of our study of the life of David. Keep watching as we look at the people, some who encouraged David and some who discouraged David during the most difficult period of his life as he tried to deal with his son Absalom's revolt. And I've got to tell you, as we dive into this morning, you know, I know that this evening is the Academy Awards, and I've got to say, I'm not a big fan of the Academy Awards. I don't think I've ever seen it, and I don't think that I've actually ever missed seeing it. But I know that there are some people who are fans, and one of the things is it seems like, and increasingly so, every year, you know, most of the movies that are nominated are movies that no one ever sees and no one cares about, and they're terrible movies, But this year, there actually was one picture that was nominated for a number of awards that I actually saw as a good movie, and that's The Darkest Hour. And it's a picture. There's some artistic retelling of our liberty in telling the story, but it's basically based on the true story of Winston Churchill's early days as Prime Minister of England, when Nazi Germany had swept across Western Europe, and he really leaving England alone in fighting against Germany, and everybody was pressuring him to surrender. And he, in this darkest of hour, had this, you know, strength to stand on up. And if you don't know about the movie, let me just introduce it by just a short trailer that kind of gives you an idea of what the movie is about.
We are in the preliminary stage of one of the greatest battles in history.
Mr. Winston Churchill,
you have an enormous task ahead of you.
Winston lacks judgment.
He's a bully. We may have to replace him.
All our forces are in Dunkirk.
The Germans are pushing us into the sea.
You have the full weight of the world on your shoulders.
Are you not afraid?
Most terribly.
I speak to you for the first time as Prime Minister in a solemn hour for the life of our country.
You ask, what is our policy? I say it is to wage war by sea, land, and air with all our might. We shall never surrender!
Again, I got to say, I'm not recommending it necessarily, but I enjoyed it. It was a powerful movie. And one of the main ideas in that is that you have this idea that at this time, virtually everyone, including most of the people in Churchill's own government, were pressuring him to capitulate, essentially by, you know, seeking peace and giving up, you know, and accepting the terms of the Germans. And everyone else looked at it and said, "We can't win this." And he saw something that no one else saw. He looked at it and he saw what he had seen even before the war. He looked at it and he said, "I look at Hitler and I know how evil this guy is." Everyone else, you know, saw only the battle. He said, the nature of the problem is Hitler is evil, and if we seek terms of peace, our country is going to be destroyed. Our civilization is going to be destroyed. In the movie, they even have him using a term that was a line that he became famous for, which was this. He said, you know, you cannot negotiate with the tiger when your head is in its mouth. And that's true, and that's what he saw. He saw the nature of the struggle. No one else saw that, and because he saw the nature of the struggle, he said, this is worth fighting. This is worth continuing on, regardless of the circumstances, regardless of the cost. Now, you might be wondering, what in the world does this have to do with the life of David? And here's the idea. What we're seeing here is something illustrated through this period of history that's illustrated and taught through this part of David's life, which is a truth in life in general. And that is that sometimes we go through major crises. We face incredible trials in life. And in the midst of this, what often happens is that we become blinded by the crisis. We become very limited in our perspective. And we don't see things properly. And so what was the case here? You had everyone else seeing the crisis, and they couldn't see the real nature of the struggle. Churchill did, and he in time shared that. He rallied the whole country and literally half of the world against Nazi Germany because he saw what no one else did. And so often, you see this in David, is that initially he's in a crisis, and he's blinded by the crisis. And in our lives, that often happens. We become blinded in the crisis that we don't see things properly. And then we make foolish decisions based on an improper perception of reality, which actually makes the problem worse. So let's see how this has played out in David's life. You know, we have this natural tendency towards confusion in the midst of crisis. And we're looking this morning mainly at chapters 15 and 16 of 2 Samuel. And they tell the story of the events surrounding the revolt of David's son Absalom. And we looked at the first half of that chapter last time in our study a couple weeks ago. But let me quickly summarize what happened. In the chapter 15, David's son Absalom pulls off a coup to overthrow his father and to take his throne. And as we saw a couple weeks ago, the whole thing, the whole coup was based on deception. It was all based on a lie. Absalom's plan was, he told his dad, well, I'm going to offer a sacrifice. And he took 200 of the best connected, most powerful people in the capital with him for this sacrifice. They thought they were just going to do a sacrifice. They didn't know Absalom's plan. And so when Absalom gets to this other city, he basically then announces, oh, these 200 people have anointed me king. They want me to be king. And so they make up a lie, and they spread this lie, and he sends people from, you know, all these different parts of the country saying, oh, this has happened, and everyone is behind Absalom. And David gets this report that, you know, that these 200 powerful people, they all want Absalom to be king. They've made him king, and Absalom now has got an army behind him. None of it's true. And David hears this, and he responds. He panics. He flees the capital. So we looked at verses 13 of chapter 15 last time. A messenger came to David saying, the hearts of the men of Israel have gone after Absalom. Now, this is one of Absalom's servants saying this. Then David said to all his servants who were with him at Jerusalem, arise and let us flee, or else there will be no escape for us from Absalom. So go quickly, lest he overtake us quickly and bring down ruin upon us and strike the city with the edge of the sword. So the king went out and all his household after him. So here's this picture. You have this king, this aging king, you know, who has been powerful, that, you know, has built this incredible capital over 30 years. And now suddenly he's told that his loved son has been plotting this revolt under his nose. And the people have all gone to the son. The people have all left him. And he believes that lie. And so he doesn't go and he doesn't go to confirm. He doesn't send any messengers to confirm what's happening. He immediately believes the lie. He responds in panic. And he makes decisions which turned out to be incredibly foolish. Oh, there was some truth. Was Absalom trying to plan a revolt? Yes. Were there a few people that were behind him? Yes, there were a few. There was a little bit of truth, but there was a whole lot of lie. And that's often a case, again, for us in the midst of crisis. We face a crisis, and there's some truth, but what happens is that Satan, people around us, will take that little bit of truth and they'll blow it out of proportion, so we begin to take that little bit of truth and then believe a lie that grows out of that. That's what happened, you know, you think of, again, 1939 in England, what happened? There was some truth, there was a problem, but it blinded people to the right perception, and they ended up almost, again, surrendering to Hitler and seeing the destruction of the English nation. So we've got to realize that that's a nature for all of us in all time. That when we face crisis, we can become overwhelmed by that and our perception becomes limited. We become blinded. We become confused. Now, the good news is that there is a defense against that natural tendency to confusion in the midst of crisis. And even beyond that, if we give into it, as David did, sometimes we can still fall, we can make those bad decisions, and even if we've done that, it's natural, there's a vortex of, you know, we make bad decisions, it makes things worse, it increases a lie, and it continues to spin out of control. But even if we've started that, there's a way out of that destructive vortex, and to start to set things right and to break that cycle. And we escape it by seeing and interpreting life accurately. Now, your notes say interrupting. That was my fault. I spelled it wrong. It's seeing and interpreting life accurately through a God-defined perspective. See, what's amazing is that if we dive into this part of David's story, we see that in a matter of literally hours, things begin to change. He hears the report. He responds negatively. There's panic. He runs away. And we're going to see within a little matter of hours, he starts to change from this depressed, defeated person that's tucking his tail between his legs and running away from everything and just basically giving up to starting to become the king again, because he starts to see things right. He begins to take charge of the situation. He begins to make wise decisions to rebuild what has so quickly become broken. And for David and for us, that always starts by remembering God, remembering his promises. See, if you have a relationship with God, if you are a follower of Jesus Christ, meaning if you've asked him to forgive your sins, if you've committed your life to follow him and to seek after him, then what you've got to realize is that he says that you are a loved child of God. That's your identity. In Hebrews, God says, I will never leave you or forsake you, that he will never abandon us. At times it may feel that way, but that's not the reality. In Philippians 1, there's a promise that Paul says, I'm sure of this, that he who began a good work in you will bring it to completion at the day of Jesus Christ. That God began a work, that God has, you know, loved us through the death of his son. You know, he's not going to just leave any of us right here. He's not going to forget about us. He's not going to abandon us. And that's the truth. And so if we are God's child, you're always in his care. Nothing happens by accident. And that means we may not always be able to see or understand what God is doing, but the fact is that his heart is that he is always involved in our lives. Now, when we start to believe that, it means a number of things. It means if we start to believe that, we're going to first of all remember that God is in control. And if we believe that God loves us and he's in control, we're going to start to look for his provision. Now, let's look at how this plays out in David's life. We pick up the story again in 2 Samuel 15, 17. And we have this tragic scene, and, you know, David and all these people are leaving Jerusalem. You know, they're all, you know, in going by, it's defeat. And if we really read the whole thing, literally what happens is you have people coming out from all the city, and they're lining the road where they're going out. People are crying and weeping because the fact of the matter is the people still love David. This was the king. This was the capital that he's built for 30 years. This was the king that had brought them great, you know, prosperity. And the people are still with David, and so they're crying. And in verse 17, we read, and the king went out, and all the people after him, they halted at the last house. And so here's the picture. They're at the edge of the city. They're, you know, the very edge of the walls. They stop at the last house. He stops, and he looks back, and he sees the capital that he built, that he's now leaving to the destruction, you know, risk of destruction of his son. And in the midst of that, there's people that start to come out to meet him. And these aren't people that are just crying. These are people that are saying, David, whatever happens, we're going to go with you. We want you to realize that, you know, in this revolt, we're not only going to root for you, we're going to stand with you, we're going to fight with you. Verse 18, and all the servants passed by him, and all the Cherites, and all the Pethlites, and all the electric lights, and all the, now if you don't have your Bibles open, that's not in there. And all the 600 Gittites who had followed him from Gath passed before the king. And so here's all these people that are saying, you know, no matter what happens, we're sticking with you. But there's one group that really stands out and that's unexpected, so much so that David calls out their leader. Verse 8 or 19, then the king said to Ittai the Gittite, why do you also go with us? Go back and stay with the king, meaning now Absalom, for you are a foreigner and also an exile from your home. You came only yesterday. Shall I now today make you wander along with us, since I know not where? Go back and take your brothers with you, and may the Lord show steadfast love and faithfulness to you. Now, here's what's happening. This is an interesting guy. See, this is not, most of these people are part of David's tribe. They are people that have been with him from the very beginning. This is not one of those people. When it says it's a Gittite, it means he's a person from the city of Gath. The city of Gath is a Philistine city, the city where Goliath was from. And so here is a Gentile, a foreigner, who has come over, and he's likely converted to Judaism. And so he's now become a follower of God, and he has now committed himself to serve David. And what David is saying, and David is saying, you know, you're just with us. You've just been with us yesterday. You're new. You know, you're just here. Why should you take this risk? And when you think about this, out of all the people that you think would follow David, this is the least likely guy. You know, why would this guy and 600 people with him basically saying, we're going to commit everything to you. We're going to support you no matter what. And he declares his support not only through his words, but through his actions. David, in essence, has said to him, you know, I know that you're supporting me. Well, go back and play it safe. But look at what he says in verse 21. But Ittai answered the king, as the Lord lives, as my Lord the King lives, wherever the Lord the King shall be, wherever for death or for life, there also will your servant be. And what you have is this incredible statement, you know, him saying, we're committed to you. Now, what I love is what this is showing is this is what true friendship is. You know, we're in the midst of crisis. You know, a lot of people you know, just desert us. You know, I don't know what to do. Handful of people that will come and say, we're praying for you, we care about you. They'll say the right things. But it's rare to have a friend that actually stands with you, that says, no matter what happens, I'm going to be there. I'm going to walk with you. I'm going to stand with you. I'm going to suffer with you. I'm going to pay the price of being with you in the midst of this. Boy, that's very valuable. And one of the things it shows is it shows that's what we need to be for each other. The fact is, we're all going to go through times of crisis. And for starters, we've got to invest time in relationships so when that happens, we have people that are already involved in our life that they can step up and be there in the midst of that crisis. But how about for those of us in our ABFs or those of us who, that we know that are good friends? Being a friend means that we don't just, you know, care for each other, but that we actually take the risk to step up, even when somebody says, "No, leave me alone. No, I'm gonna go through this with you. I'm gonna, no matter what happens, I'm not gonna give up on you. I'm gonna walk through this with you." But there's something even more than that. Because what happens is at this point in time, David feels like everyone has given up on him. You know, his son has given up on him. Everybody has given up. God's not here. And we saw some of that a couple weeks ago in Psalm 3. That's what he feels. But what we need to realize is that God is always there. God never leaves us by ourselves. What happens is that oftentimes we go through this crisis and we're looking at the things that we feel like God isn't doing. We look at the things that we feel like, God, this is a prayer. Why aren't you doing this? Why aren't you stopping Absalom? Why aren't you stopping this person from attacking me? God, why aren't you providing this? And in the midst of it, we can often become focused on what God isn't doing, and we miss what God is doing. Because God is always working. God is always providing a means of help, a means of support. And usually, if not always, it's through people. It's through people that step up, and often these unexpected people that say, I'm going to be there with you. And God is ministering to us through the people, not often the way that we looked for or expect, but in the way that we need. But here's the thing that we need to remember. See, at first, David almost missed this. You know, these people come, and David said, no, go back. You know, you don't need to go with me. And he missed the fact that God was there. God was taking care of him. He's wanting to reject it. But the reality is that God was sending his provision to David in the midst of the crisis, and he does that for each one of us. But if we miss it, what happens is we can reject what God is providing for us. The person could be right there, and we miss it, and we feel just dejected, and we feel like abandoned by God. Or we can take full advantage of the way that God is providing for us and not only appreciate the person, but realize that in that person we see God's hand as well. That God hasn't abandoned us. And he's communicating his love, maybe not in the way that we hope or expect, but he's communicating his love and his provision through these unexpected means. Well, secondly, we look at that and we can realize that we can escape the confusion of the crisis and begin seeing, interpreting life accurately when we then find peace and security in God and our relationship with him. Now, this is the idea that's played out in verses 24 through 28 of chapter 15. Again, the picture is, again, David's leaving Jerusalem. Everybody is defeated. And as they go out, it's not only that there's certain groups that are coming out and saying, we're coming with you, but then there's another surprise. There's a group of priests that come out to meet him. Look at verse 24. And Abiathar came up, and behold, Zadok came also with all the Levites bearing the Ark of the Covenant of God. And they set down the Ark of God until all the people had passed out of the city. And I think what they did at first is they're coming out and they're saying, David, not only are we with you, but we wanted you to know that we believe that God is with you. That, yeah, Absalom has anointed himself king, but you're the person that God anointed king through the prophet Samuel. That just because he calls himself king doesn't mean that God is with them. We believe that God is with you. And not only that, we're going to take the ark, and we want to symbolize that because the ark was this, you know, this piece of furniture that was at the center of the tabernacle. It symbolized God's presence. And so we want you to know that God is with you. And not only that, but when you take the ark, see, a lot of people thought there was some magical power in the ark. Some of you might remember the old movie Raiders of the Lost Ark. You know, and this had this idea that, you know, the Germans thought the Ark of the Covenant, they were looking to find it because they thought it was magical. And if they had the ark, then they couldn't lose because they manipulated the power of God to win the battles for them. And people believed that back in David's day. And they said, okay, if you have the ark, you know, basically all the people are going to rally to you because they're going to see that you have God, and you can't lose a battle because you have God. And what David realized is that, no, I don't need to manipulate God. I don't need the ark. I don't need the symbol of his power. What I need is I need his presence. Look at verse 25. The king said to Zadok, this is one of the priests, carry the ark of God back into the city. If I find favor in the eyes of the Lord, he will bring me back and let me see both it and its his dwelling place. But if he says, I have no pleasure in you, behold, here I am. Let him do to me as it seems good to him. Now, basically, he's showing that he understands theology a whole lot more than the priest did. And what he's saying is, no, I don't need the ark. I don't need the symbol of his power to make his power work for me. What I need is I need his presence. I have a relationship with him. And because I have a relationship with him, that's what matters the most. He realized this, which is true for us. Our greatest need is always God's presence, not his power or his provision. See, in the midst of crisis, what we're looking for is we're looking for his power. We're looking for his provision. God, win this battle. Do this. And I know if you do this, then you're taking care of me. God says, well, I may not do what you want me to do all the time, but what you've got to realize is what you need isn't what my power. What you need is me. Let's think of it in terms of even a parent, a young child. You know, if a young child comes and they said, you know, boy, I found something in the store. Can I have $3? Can I buy this? And they scream and rant because they want $3, and they think that their dad has to give them $3. And their whole identity of, you know, you don't love me if you don't give me $3. Now, the fact is, does a child need $3? At that moment, they think they do. But do they need that money? You know what they need? Is they need a relationship with dad. Because if you got a relationship with dad, you've got the source where all the provision comes from. Now, that may mean at times dad doesn't give you everything that you demand, but dad's always going to give you all the things that you need. And that's what we have. We have a loving father that sometimes we say, God, I need this. I want your money. I want your power. I want you to do this. And God says, no, if you have me, if you have a relationship with me and trust that I am a loving, powerful dad, what you've got to realize is that I'm going to take care of you. I'm going to meet your needs. What we need is relationship with him. Now, I want to realize there may be some here that you're going through trials and you're going through crisis, and there may be some people who don't have a relationship with God. You haven't been in church in a long time, but you're going through a crisis and you suddenly realize, well, maybe I need God. You know, there's the old saying is there's no atheists in foxholes. We go through a crisis and suddenly we realize that we need something spiritual. And maybe you've come today looking for God's provision or his power, for God to fix that problem. But what I want you to realize is what we all need, what you need is a relationship with him. You don't need his power, you don't need his provision, you need him. And if you have him, you have all the stuff that comes with him. And that starts by recognizing that we're separated from God naturally by our sin and asking God to forgive our sin through Jesus Christ and his death on the cross. And when he forgives us, he gives us a relationship, so we then become a child of God. God says, are you willing not to come to me for what I can give you, but are you willing to come to me for me, for a relationship with me? And to trust that if you have me, you have everything that I'm gonna provide, all the things that you need. The third thing that we see in chapter 15 about escaping this confusion and beginning to see life accurately is that we need to look for God's plan and act on what we see. Let's go back to chapter 15, starting in verse 30. When David went up the ascent of the Mount of Olives, weeping as he went, barefoot and with his head covered, all the people were with him, covered their heads, and they went up weeping as he went. And it was told to David, Ahithophel is among the conspirators with Absalom. And David said, O Lord, please turn the counsel of Ahithophel into foolishness. And basically, what we see is that, you know, he says, one of your chief counselors is with him. And in this, you see his response is that he has already begun to change radically. Because up till now, it's been, man, a crisis. I can't believe it. How do I run? And at this point, he hears this, and instead of being broken by his friend's betrayal, he immediately says, okay, God, you've got a plan in this. He immediately says, okay, God, this person has betrayed me. I pray now that you turn his counsel, his wisdom, into foolishness. And look at what then happens as soon as he finishes prayer, verse 32. Now, David was coming to the summit where God was worshipped, and behold, Hishai the Archite had came to meet him with his coat torn and dirt on his head. So as soon as he comes there, this guy comes and meets him, and David immediately, after praying, says, okay, God, why are you sending this guy? And he interprets it as an answer to prayer and comes up with a strategy. Verse 33, David said to him, if you go on with me, you'll be a burden to me. But if you return to the city and say to Absalom, I will be your servant, O king, as I have been your father's servant in time past, so now also I will be your servant, then you will defeat for me the counsel of Ahithophel. Are you not Zodak and Afar the priests there with you? So whatever you hear from the king's house, tell it to them. And behold, their two sons are with them also. And basically, you know, they're going to come and tell me everything that they hear. So here's what's happening, is that he looks at this and he's already starting to say, God's in charge. I believe that God's got a plan. I prayed a prayer. Okay, God, how is this an answer? And he begins to look at it from a perspective of saying, I believe that God has something good. See, what we need to realize is that it's a challenge of this. Is that how do we learn to look at life from the perspective of a sovereignist? You say, what in the world? I made up that word. I know it's not a real word. Now, here's what I mean. You know, when you think of an optimist is a person that sees only the good. You know, I'm by nature more the optimist. I'm the guy that, you know, just, I assume that I'm going to hit a green light every time. Everything's going to work out well. And the pessimist is the person that tends to see only the bad. Now, the pessimist will tell you that they're the people that don't see the bad. They see the real. They're the realists. And you know, the optimist, oh, it's just pessimism. And you look at that and you say, you know, even they, you know, the joke is, you know, you give a pessimistic child a pet and they start complaining about how much work it's going to be to take care of them. You take an optimistic child and you put them in a full room full of manure, and they're going to get excited and say, man, with all this manure, there's got to be a pony in here somewhere. And that's the kind of the joke of that. Now, the question is, what is God? Is he an optimist or a pessimist? And I tell you, I often thought that, you know, earlier on that God was the optimist. Well, God of course, he knows things are going to turn out well. But, you know, the more I studied his word, what you realized is that he also, at the same point, is incredibly realistic about problems, incredibly realistic about pain and against trials. And what I realize is that there's another word. He's not an optimist or pessimist. There's the idea of being a sovereignist, of the idea of recognizing that God knows everything's going to work out. Everything's got a plan, but it's not an ignoring of the problems. It's being totally real about the problems and trials and crises of life, but at the same time saying, okay, God, how do I see the good in the midst of the bad? You know, a great example of this, a verse I love, Philippians chapter 1, Paul's talking about this. People are all worried about him because he's, you know, trying to preach God's word, and he's been arrested for 2 years, and he's in prison, and they're like, man, Paul, you got to be discouraged about that. Look at what Paul does, the perspective of the sovereignist. He says this, I want you to know, brothers, that what has happened to me, here my imprisonment and being chained up for 2 years, has really served to advance the gospel, so that it's become known throughout the whole imperial guard, and to all the rest that my imprisonment is for Christ, and most of the brothers have become confident in the Lord of my imprisonment, are much more bold to speak the word without fear. And basically what he's saying is, boy, I realized I was chained up, and you know, I had guards that were chained to me all the time, and I realized, man, God's got a plan. Where's the plan? God helped me to see the plan. This is bad. I don't like to be chained up, but you know what? These guards are Caesar's guards. I've got a captive audience. They can't leave. You know, so I can preach to them, and they've got an 8-hour duty, and they've got to hear everything that I tell them. So, you know, boy, God, you know, I'm not in prison. You send me some of the who's who of Rome, and I get to preach to them 8 hours at a time, so that through these 2 years, man, all of Rome's heard the gospel. Man, this is a great opportunity. I love that. That's the sovereignist. And it means that we not only look for something good, but then we act on it like Paul did. So those are three ideas. How do we escape that? How do we see things properly? But I want to tell you that even if we do, there will still be traps. There will be snares. There will be things that will try to drag us back down into this negative thinking of confusion. And again, we see this back here as we go back to David's life in 2 Samuel. And how do we avoid these snares that are common in these times of crisis? And we're going to see two here in the beginning of the first half of chapter 16. One he responds well to, one he responds not so well to. The first one is the one he doesn't do well, and that's the trap of recognizing that in the midst of the crisis, our perception may be flawed, and so we have to make decisions really cautiously. And that's what happens. Now, if we go back to look at chapter 16, verse 1, and I apologize. I know I'm slaughtering all these names. I don't do well with this, but you don't want to read them publicly either. So 16:1. When David had passed a little beyond the summit, Ziba, the servant of Mephibosheth, met him with a couple of donkeys saddled bearing 200 loaves of bread, 100 bunches of raisins, 100 summer fruits, and a skin of wine. And the king said to Ziba, "Why have you brought these?" And Ziba answered, "The donkeys for the king's household to ride on, and the bread and summer fruit are for the young men to eat, and the wine is for those who are faint in the wilderness to drink." And the king said, "Where is your master's son?" And Ziba said to the king, "Behold, he remains in Jerusalem, for he said, 'Today the house of Israel will give me back the kingdom of my father.'" And the king said to Ziba, "Behold, all that belonged to Mephibosheth is now yours." And Ziba said, "I pay homage. Let me find favor in your sight, my lord the king." Now, at first you might say, well, that doesn't seem like a trial. This guy is helping David. You know, this is helping. Now, here's what you've got to realize, is that this is someone who's taking advantage of David in the crisis. And this is often the way that people do it to us as well. We're in the midst of crisis. You have people that will come and take advantage of us and our perception by pretending to be our friend, by offering to help us in some way, but really they have their own agenda. Now, to see that, we've got to remember, who's this guy Ziba? This guy Ziba, we first meet him in 2 Samuel 9, and David had come back, and he says, "I want to show kindness to someone in Saul's family." And he's told about this, you know, his oldest son, Jonathan, and Jonathan had a son named Mephibosheth, and he's the only one living, but he was crippled. He had been dropped when he was little, and he was crippled. And so David called him in, and he had been hiding because he'd been afraid that David would want to kill him. And David called him in and says, "No, I want to treat you with kindness." And he gives him all this property, and he gives him the right to live in the palace. And he then assigns this guy Ziba to be the servant to manage things for Mephibosheth. Now, in the midst of that, you look at it and say, that's pretty good for Ziba. He's got a lot of power and a lot of, but it's not his. He's doing it for someone else. Now we go back to the present. David's running from Jerusalem, and since both Ziba and Mephibosheth are living in the palace, they know it. But Ziba, the servant, now meets David, and he's got all these supplies, and he says, "Okay, I'm here to take care of you." And David says, "Well, whose stuff is this?" And he says, "Well, it's Mephibosheth's stuff." And David says, "So why are you bringing it to me?" And he says, "Well, Mephibosheth is, you know, he's joining the revolt. He's basically hoping that Absalom is going to make him king." Now, when you look at that, you know, you say, that doesn't make sense. I mean, it's obviously a lie. And if you go to chapter 19, you find out that it's a lie. What you have is Mephibosheth is crippled. He can't go. So Ziba basically takes all this stuff and leaves his master there and says, "Okay, let me try to use this to my advantage so I can say that he's betrayed you, but I'm the one that's taking care of you." And so he gives this incredible lie, and the problem is that David buys it. He's in the middle of the crisis. All he knows is this person's bringing him stuff that's helpful, and he buys the lie about this guy Mephibosheth. And next thing you know, what does he do? He basically looks and he says, "Okay, you know, all the stuff that I gave to Mephibosheth, it's all yours. You know, we just, you know, we're going to punish him." Now, here's what we have to realize is what we see in this picture here is we're in the midst of a crisis. We got to be careful about making decisions. Because when we're going through the most taxing of trial, we still have to deal with everyday issues. We still have to deal with decisions. Things still are there. And not only that, but people will often try to force themselves in our lives to try to make us make those decisions. But our perception is limited, and we're worn out, and we're discouraged, and we don't want to do the hard work of actually trying to make sure what's right. And in the process, we often end up making really foolish decisions that we later regret. The thing is that in the purpose of trials, God is trying to drive us beyond ourselves so that we can become more dependent on Him. And one of the things that we can do is that at times we could say, well, you know, dependency on God is just to give up and surrender and just whatever happens. But that's not what we're called to do. See, dependency of God is something that even though we're tired, it's still something that we have to put energy towards. So a couple ideas, just real three principles. You know, say, what are some biblical principles that we need in seeking wisdom in the midst of crisis? The first one is this: seek God's wisdom in His Word. You look at it, take time and pray for God's good. God, is there something here that in Your Word that speaks to this issue? Is there a principle? What should I learn? And second of all, that we need to pray for God's perspective and wisdom. See, David, even before this, when people are coming, he's praying and he's saying, God, help me to understand this. But in this case, he doesn't do that. He just responds. And we need to say, God, help me to see. I know that my perspective is limited, and what I need is I need wisdom and perspective that I don't have of my own. God, give me that perspective. And third of all, that we need to pray for or seek wise counsel. The Bible speaks about this and how important it is that we've got to realize that especially in times of crisis, all the time it's important, but especially in time of crisis, what happens is that because our perspective is limited, there are things that I'm not going to see. And so I need to find wise people around me who aren't in the midst of the storm and say, help me to understand this. You know, this looks right for me, but help me to see what I'm not seeing. Look what Proverbs says. Without counsel, plans fail, but with many advisors, they succeed. You know, the importance of seeking, that's a biblical concept. So the last warning here that we have, the last thing that we have to avoid is that we also have to be careful to respond wisely to those who kick us when we're down. And pick it up in verse 5. When King David came to Bahurim, there came a man out of the family of the house of Saul, a man whose name was Shimei, the son of Gera. As he came, he cursed it continuously. He threw stones at David and all the servants of King David and all the people and the mighty men who were at his right hand and on his left. And Shimei said as he cursed, "Get out, you man of blood, you worthless man. The Lord has avenged you on you all the blood of the house of Saul, in whose place you have reigned. And the Lord has given you the kingdom in the hand of your son Absalom. See, your evil is on you, for you are a man of blood." Now this guy's really gutsy. You know, here you have David. He's going out, but he's got like a lot of armed people with him. And he starts throwing stones, cursing him. And the fact is, we all know people like that. How many of us can relate? You know, we're down and we've got people that will come out and kick us when we're down. They'll criticize us. They'll beat us up. They know that we're weak. And David's feeling defeated. Now, here's what I want you to realize. You know, in Revelation chapter 12, it said that Satan is one of his names. He's the accuser of the brethren. You know, one of the things that he does is he throws accusations at us. He beats us when he's down. He tells us how we failed. He tells us about how bad we are. Even here, it's like, well, you deserve this. And you know, has David done some things that are wrong? Yeah, but God has forgiven him. And so we've got to realize that we will face that attack. And the natural tendency is to attack back. And if you look at verse 9, one of David's men said that's what his idea is. Then Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, said to the king, "Why should this dead dog curse the Lord my king? Let me go over and take off his head." That's pretty direct counsel. You know, why should you let this happen? I'll go dispatch him for you. And David could have said, "I just, you know, man, you don't understand. I'm the king. This is right." But what he does is he responds this case rightly. He shows wisdom. And let me just briefly, three principles for reacting with wisdom that we see here for David. First of all, we need to ask God if he might be a good purpose or a lesson for us, even in the bad. You know, basically, could God have some purpose that he's trying to teach me? Look at verse 16, or 10, I'm sorry. The king said, "What do I have to do with you, sons of Uriah? If he is cursing because the Lord has said to him, 'Curse David,' then who shall say, 'Why have you done so?'" In other words, he's saying, we're not going to kill him. What I've got to do is I've got to say, maybe there's something here that God's trying to tell me. I know that he's got a bad purpose, but I've got to listen. You know what? When people attack me, when people curse me, people criticize me, what I realize is a lot of times they want to harm me, but most of the time there's some truth in what they're saying. There's something that I've done that has opened up the door that has allowed them to attack me. Now, there might be 2% truth and a whole bunch of lie, but what I think David's saying, which we need to do, is to say, I want to own the 2% of truth. I want to be able to look at that as some people say, you know, I want to take the meat and spit out the bone. And it might be almost all bone, but if there's a little bit of meat, I'm willing to say, God, what are you trying to teach me through this? Second, we need to understand that these trials that we face are a normal part of life. We will have trials, we will have opposition, we will have people attack us. And so when we're down, we shouldn't be surprised by that. Look at verse 11. David said to Abishai and all his servants, "Behold, my own son seeks my life. How much more shall this Benjamite? Leave him alone. Let him curse. The Lord has told him to." And basically saying, you know, why should I be surprised by this? Now, this is something that we see here, but Jesus teaches this all the time. He says, if we're a follower of Jesus, we've got to realize people will persecute us. People will oppose us. Look at what Jesus says in John 13 or 16. "I have said these things to you that you may have peace. In the world, you will have tribulation, but take heart, I have overcome the world. In this world, you will be opposed. In this world, things will be hard. In this world, there will be persecution and tribulation. And if we understand that, it actually gets easier. Because where I get destroyed by it is when I don't expect it and I'm blindsided. And David says, no, this is part of life. And I accept tribulation and persecution and attack as part of life. I'm not defeated by it. Because life is hard, but you know what? God is gracious, even in the midst of difficulty. And lastly, remember that God's sovereignty and trust in his plan. Look at verse 12. It may be that the Lord will look upon the wrong done to me, that the Lord will repay me with the good for his cursing this day. And basically saying, God's in charge. God can fight my battles. And the fact is, I don't need to fix everything. I don't need to set everything right. Truth and time go hand in hand. And I'm willing to sit back and say, God, you know that this person's attacking me. And God, if I'm being wronged, I trust it to you because you're going to do a better job setting things right than I will be. And what you see is in him responding in a way that could have caused a whole lot more damage. But because he saw wisdom, he reacted with wisdom. And God ended up blessing that wisdom, even in the midst of crisis.
Thanks for watching. If you have any questions about what we talked about, Jesus Christ, or church, feel free to reach out to us on Facebook, Instagram, or by email. The links are in the description.